On this June 15th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. And here are some of your Tuesday headlines. The president in Switzerland tonight on the eve of his important summit with Russian leader Vladimir Putin. President Biden has spent the last several days attending meetings with America's allies at the G7 in England and with our NATO allies in Brussels, all leading up to tomorrow's highly anticipated one-on-one in Geneva. The two leaders will come face-to-face at a moment when both men agree that U.S.-Russian relations are, quote, at a low point. On Capitol Hill, the infrastructure negotiations continue, but Democrats may go it alone if they cannot reach an agreement with Republicans within the next week and a half. The CDC has classified that Delta variant of coronavirus first found in India as a, quote, variant of concern. The change is based on what they call mounting evidence that the Delta variant spreads more easily and causes more severe cases when compared to other variants, that official statement from the CDC. And the White House announcing today that the president and first lady will host essential workers and military families for what the administration is calling independence from virus on the 4th of July. Just some of the stories shaping Washington today ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with the very latest on COVID-19. A new research study by NIH has turned up evidence of possible coronavirus infections in the U.S. as early as December of 2019. That's important because it's weeks before the first documented infection in this country. The report published in the Journal of Clinical Infectious Diseases, bolstering earlier studies indicating that the virus entered the country under the radar and may have been spreading the first 2 months of 2020. That's well in advance of the warnings to the effect from the CDC and other public health officials. All of this comes as states are beginning to ease restrictions put in place 16 months ago. California, for example, is now open for business as it returns to a new sense of normalcy. However, large indoor events like NBA games and concerts will require a negative coronavirus test or proof of vaccination for entry. The state has strongly recommended similar requirements for admission to large outdoor venues, such as Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles. New York is also easing those restrictions. While across the Atlantic and Great Britain, that country is keeping limits in place for another few weeks because of the spread of that new variant in the country. This comes as Congress gaveled in this morning with the House chaplain Margaret Kibben making reference to a new milestone in the U.S. with this pandemic.
Holy God, even as we acknowledge the tragedy of over 600,000 deaths this pandemic has wrought on our country and the devastation it has caused around the world, help us to find the gift we are now being given, the opportunity to emerge carefully from the fear and anxiety COVID has imposed on our daily living and rediscover the importance of our relationships one with another. What a joy it is to see someone else's whole face, to look not just in their eyes, but to be graced by their whole countenance. As we dare to unmask, may we dare also to reveal our hearts to one another and rediscover the gift of being in fellowship. Even as we risk exposure to the enduring dangers of our environment, may we also risk exposing ourselves to the challenge of frank and open, albeit respectful, interchange of ideas and diversity of thought. In sharing our heartfelt thoughts and opinions, may we also find ways to share care and concern with those whose perspectives are at times drastically different from our own. May we, our faces, our whole selves, unhidden and unrestrained, reflect your generosity, mercy, and love. Then reveal yourself to us in the face of those with whom we serve this day. In your merciful name we pray. Amen.
And that is how the day began with the House Chaplain Margaret Kibben. We carry the House live on C-SPAN. Meanwhile, the House Oversight and Reform Committee heard from FBI Director Christopher Wray, facing a new round of questions on what led to that uprising inside the Capitol on January the 6th. Democrat Carolyn Maloney of New York chairs the committee.
The committee has obtained documents showing that social media company Parler sent the FBI evidence of planned violence in Washington, D.C. on January 6. Parler referred this content to the FBI for investigation over 50 times. And according to the company, quote, even alerted law enforcement to specific threats of violence being planned at the Capitol, end quote. I'd like to ask about one tip in particular. The committee has obtained an email in which an employee from Parler shared a social media post with an FBI liaison. In that post, a Parler user stated, and I quote, "This is not a rally. It's no longer a protest. This is a final stand where we are drawing a red line at Capitol Hill," end quote. The user later said, and I quote, "Don't be surprised if we take the Capitol building," end quote. The user concluded, "Trump needs us to cause chaos to enact the Insurrection Act," end quote. This information was passed to the FBI on January 2nd. Director Wray, were you made aware of this email from Parler prior to January 6th, yes or no? Were you aware of this communication from Parler?
Well, Maloney, I do not recall hearing about this particular email, certainly not before January 6th.
Were you aware of the 50 times that Parler tried to contact your office about an insurrection?
I'm not aware of Parler ever trying to contact my office. I am aware since January 6th that Parler has made some comments about its communications with the FBI. My understanding is that they send emails to a particular field office and that some of those contain possible threat information. And some of them were referred to domestic terrorism squads for follow-up. And we've been taking a hard look at the various emails that Parler sent to assess the accuracy of their assertions and whether further action is warranted. You also mentioned the Norfolk report, and I guess I do want to be clear that that information, raw, unverified information, as unfortunately so much of the information these days is on social media, was quickly passed to all of our partners in three different ways. Almost immediately. So I do want to be clear about that particular piece.
The testimony of Christopher Wray, the FBI director on Capitol Hill. Now, last week, a bipartisan Senate report showed some of the security failures surrounding the January 6th insurrection and also pointed to Parler and other social media sites that gave an indication of what was about to happen that afternoon. Also at today's hearing, Republican Congressman Brian Stile of Wisconsin with questions to the Inspector General Michael Bolton and Dr. Greta Goodwin, who serves as the director of the GAO's Homeland Security and Justice Team.
You've issued a total of 65 recommendations to the United States Capitol Police. We commend the efforts of you and your team. Have you seen an overarching strategy for how these recommendations are to be implemented in a systematic way?
No, sir, I have not. Although the department has just recently requested the closure of several recommendations on our second flash report, and we did close two recommendations related to the first flash report, that's not something that the department probably would share unless they request. But I do know that they do send over an updated report every week to the Capitol Police Board.
So safe to say some of these recommendations have been made, but you've not seen a systematic approach to addressing the number of items that you've identified for them?
That would be correct.
And how many times have you met with the United States Capitol Police to discuss the recommendations that you and your office have made since January 6th?
I believe it would be, well, met with the audit liaison, or my folks in my office have contacted the audit liaison to get updates on the status of recommendations, I have not met personally with the command staff.
So you personally have not met with the command staff since January 6th, and how many times have you met with the Capitol Police Board since January 6th?
During the normal course of the Capitol Police Board meetings, I believe it was either two or three times.
Two or three times. Let me shift gears to you, Ms. Goodwin. I appreciate you being here and your work as well. Would you say that the recommendations issued by the Inspector General are important for ensuring that the United States Capitol Police is operating by industry best standards and is held accountable?
Yes.
And who is directly responsible for overseeing the United States Capitol Police Board?
So that would be...
Or the United States Capitol Police, excuse me.
Oh, the Capitol...
I led the witness.
So this committee, the Senate Rules Committee... and the Legislative Branch, Ledge Branch Appropriations Committee, those are the four committees that the Capitol Police Board report to.
But the, in the United States Capitol Police.
The Capitol Police report to the board. And also, Mr. Bolton reports to the board. So that's something that is also could also be an issue. All of these entities are reporting to the board. The board is then, of course, reporting to you all. But the communication, I think, between the committees and the board is could be better.
The full hearing from the House Administration Committee is available on our website at cspan.org. You are hearing from officials from GAO and the Inspector General, and questions from Congressman Brian Steil, Republican of Wisconsin. Meanwhile, the Attorney General Merrick Garland announcing a new strategy to combat domestic terrorism after the White House completed its own assessment of the threat posed by domestic extremism. That following what happened on January 6th here in Washington at the U.S. Capitol. More from the Justice Department.
I'm pleased to announce that the administration is today releasing the first national strategy for countering domestic terrorism. Each of your components will play an important role in ensuring its success. The national strategy is designed to coordinate and provide a principled path for the federal government's efforts to counter the heightened domestic terrorism threat using all available tools. It is the culmination of an effort undertaken at the President's direction by federal agencies all across the government, from the Justice Department to the Departments of Homeland Security, Defense, State, Health and Human Services, and others. As part of this effort, our law enforcement and intelligence agencies examined the evolving threat that faces us today. From that base of understanding, we developed this national strategy to guide the work of a broad set of federal actors. At the Justice Department, the Deputy Attorney General and I have already begun implementing a range of measures. Among other things, we have begun to reinvigorate the Domestic Terrorism Executive Committee, and we will convene that interagency body in the coming days and months. Attorney General Janet Reno originally created the Executive Committee in the aftermath of the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. The investigation of that bombing, which required an enormous commitment of resources from agencies across the federal and state governments, had demonstrated the importance of such a coordination mechanism. Our current effort comes on the heels of another large and heinous attack, this time the January 6th assault on our nation's capital. We have now, as we have then, an enormous task ahead to move forward as a country, to punish the perpetrators, to do everything possible to prevent similar attacks, and to do so in a manner that affirms the values on which our justice system is founded and upon which our democracy depends.
John Bresnahan is the co-founder of Punchbowl News. He's been following the January 6th story and is joining us on the phone from Capitol Hill. So let's begin with Speaker Nancy Pelosi. What is the latest with her plan to investigate what happened on January 6th?
Well, Speaker Pelosi announced that she's still considering what to do next. She met with a group of seven committee chairs, Democratic committee chairs, to talk about the investigation and to talk about what the individual committees are doing right now and what they should do next. There's a number of options under consideration. They could do a select committee. She could name a select committee. There could be, you know, she could appoint one committee to oversee the efforts of all these other committees. She could just let the committees do their own thing, just let them continue their own lines of inquiry. Or she could try again to push maybe a revised January 6th commission bill. That sounds like the least likely option at this point. I think the choice probably she faces is, you know, a select committee or let one committee take the lead for the House in conducting this inquiry.
Let me follow up with a two-part question. First, why the delay? And is there still a sense among members of Congress to get this done before the end of the year so it doesn't spill into 2022, the midterm election?
Well, Pelosi said that she wanted to give the Senate time to reconsider whether it would move the bipartisan January 6th commission bill. It passed the House on a big bipartisan vote, 35 House Republicans, voted for it, plus all the House Democrats. So they, you know, she said she wanted to give them a chance to reconsider it. That wasn't going to happen. So clearly Pelosi, and of course the House was not in session. The members were not here for several weeks. So that was part of the delay. You know, Pelosi, you know, these chairs want it. They want to run this investigation themselves. I mean, they're committee chairs. They want to oversee this. This is very high profile. This is a very important investigation, of course. I think they want it for their own jurisdiction, for their own committees. There's concerns on about how that would work. I don't think the December deadline is an issue for Democrats because, you know, if they're not going to do a bipartisan commission, I don't think they're going to worry about whether this drags into 2022. It's clear Trump is going to be out there politically in 2022. He's going to be endorsing members. He may be doing events like he spoke in North Carolina recently in the North Carolina Republican Party. So I think the feeling of the former president is out there, doing his thing, that the House and the Congress has the right to do whatever it wants to do on its own timetable.
You began this morning by saying it's, quote, a busy day for party strategizing, Democrats and Republicans, House and the Senate. What else is happening?
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion on infrastructure. That's the topic du jour. On the Senate side in particular, there was a group of 10 that go by various names. Where some people are calling it the 5x5. There are 10 senators, 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, led by Senators Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat of Arizona, and Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio. They struck a deal, a broad agreement on a $974 billion five-year infrastructure plan. The Republicans in that group were making a presentation to the broader Senate Republican Conference today. There was a lot of questions. There was a lot of discussion about that. On the Senate side, on the Republican Democratic side, there is a lot of concern about progressives about that doesn't go far enough, that if they supported that package, they wouldn't get what they want on broader infrastructure issues, which includes, child care, health care, which issues Democrats consider infrastructure, soft infrastructure, if you would, or human infrastructure, as they're calling it, and the White House has called it. So there's a lot of, jockeying going on that. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced he would be meeting with the Democrats on the Senate Budget Committee tomorrow to talk about a unity budget. He wants to have them prepare a reconciliation bill for July, or a resolution that would – reconciliation is you would pass – you're able to pass – it's a process where you're able to pass a bill just on a simple majority vote instead of 60. To do that, you need to pass a budget resolution first. It's kind of a convoluted process, but that's how the Senate works. He needs the Senate Budget Committee to do a resolution first on for FY 2022 that would allow him to move toward reconciliation. That's a two-step process. So he's going to meet with the Senate Budget Committee Democrats tomorrow. They're led by Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, the independent from Vermont. He's the chair of that committee, and they will talk about how they craft this reconciliation instructions in case, what it would look like, what they want to have inside the package. So he'll have a discussion with them on that. So there's a lot of positioning going on right now. Can we get a bipartisan deal? Would that happen? In the meantime, can Democrats get 50 votes to do a reconciliation bill and jam through something on their own through the Senate? So there's a lot of pieces being moved around on the board today.
John Bresnahan is the co-founder of Punchbowl News. He's joining us on Capitol Hill this Tuesday. As always, we thank you for your time and insights.
Thanks so much.
And let's stay with the infrastructure story, because White House officials telling House Democrats earlier today to get ready to go it alone. If that happens, it means a bipartisan deal is essentially dead, setting the stage for party leaders to tap that obscure budget procedure that John Bresnahan referred to, known as reconciliation. And TheHill.com is reporting that senior White House officials did meet in person with members of the House Democratic Caucus. Among those in the session, senior Biden advisor Steve Ricchetti, who said that he would give Senate negotiators another 7 to to 10 days to reach some sort of bipartisan agreement. If no deal is reached in that time, Democrats will then assess the progress of those talks and decide whether to move ahead with only Democratic support. So where do things stand in the Senate? Here is Democratic leader Chuck Schumer.
Most of your rank-and-file members think that this bipartisan negotiation isn't big enough, doesn't have enough things. So is this just a facade? Why
no.
are you waiting for this?
Okay,
these
look,
talks?
There are a good number of members in our caucus who say to us, whenever you can do something bipartisan, you ought to try. And we are. And we had good success, not only in the bills that have already passed, the water bill, the anti-Asian bill, the USICA bill, but we're moving forward on surface transportation. The Commerce Committee marks up its addition to that. The Banking Committee has done it. There are members with very justified views, whatever you can do bipartisan, we should try. But alongside that is the view that that won't be enough. It won't be enough on climate. It won't be enough on revenues. It won't be enough on some of the human infrastructure, like paid leave and child care and things like that. So we're proceeding on both tracks.
Mr.
Yes.
Leader,
yes.
You have 50 votes for a budget resolution now, and when do you expect to reach the Senate floor?
We hope to get the budget resolution, which, as you know how it works. The budget resolution has the big top-line numbers, needs 50 votes, has to go through reconciliation, and then you work out all the details. But we hope to get that first budget resolution on the floor in and passed in July, as well as the bipartisan proposal.
Okay. Elizabeth Warren and others say that the bipartisan infrastructure package and the larger reconciliation package have to be part of the same global deal. Can you get all negotiated at the same time? You talked about just bringing a budget resolution to the floor, but can you actually get the details of that reconciliation?
I think there are large numbers of people in our caucus, and I sympathize with this, who will not vote for a bipartisan bill unless they're quite certain what's going to be in reconciliation.
And that's from the Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer of New York. And again, there is that group of 10 senators, 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans. They're trying to secure that agreement that could pass both chambers and win the president's support. But as you've been hearing, that group is facing some pretty fierce headwinds, in part Republican conservatives already objecting to the early price tag of the package and liberal Democrats saying that the bill does not go far enough. So with that, here is the Republican leader, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky.
Pause to do a bipartisan infrastructure bill if Democrats plan on just passing their own agenda immediately after that on a reconciliation bill?
Well, I think the majority leader's indicated there will be a reconciliation effort. I think what they're wrestling with is what will it contain. So we are anticipating at some point getting a reconciliation bill. I guess what we will find out soon is whether there is an additional bipartisan effort to address a subject that a lot of us would like to address.
Could you clarify your comments from yesterday about the Supreme Court? Are you saying that if you're the majority leader in 2023, if there's a vacancy in the Supreme Court, you will not move on a Biden nomination?
Yeah, when I made the decision I did back in 2016 with regard to a vacancy on the Supreme Court occurring in a presidential year, I was very much aware of the fact that when you had divided government, there had not been a nominee confirmed by a Senate of a different party from the president since the 1880s. I was also aware that Joe Biden, chairman of the Judiciary Committee in 1992, a time of divided government, had said, had a vacancy occurred, they would not fill it. So what I said yesterday, Manu, was simply to repeat the position I took in 2016. I'm absolutely confident if the shoe had been on the other foot, the other side would have done exactly the same.
2023. That from the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell asked about 2023, but referring to 2024 and what happened back in 2016. Also today, the president announcing his first slate of political ambassadors today, selecting some familiar Washington names to some key foreign postings. Tom Nides, a former State Department official, has been nominated to serve as the U.S. ambassador to Israel. Julie Smith, a former Biden national security advisor, has been selected to represent the U.S. as the ambassador to NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. and Ken Salazar, the former Secretary of the Interior and Senator from Colorado, as the ambassador to Mexico. The president will also nominate C.B. Sully Sullenberger, a familiar name. He safely landed that U.S. airplane on the Hudson River in 2009. He's been nominated to serve as the representative of the Council of the International Civil Aviation Organization. And you're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back. This is Washington Today for Tuesday here on C-SPAN Radio. And here are some of your other headlines. By a vote of 69-28, the Senate today confirming antitrust expert Lina Khan as the commissioner on the Federal Trade Commission. The president has one remaining commissioner position to fill to round out the five FTC sites. And the heat wave across the western part of the country could break nearly 200 daily record highs by the end of this week. Those scorching temperatures coming at a time when climate officials are calling it, quote, mega drought conditions. For example, water levels at Lake Mead, which is the nation's largest reservoir, located along the Arizona-Nevada border, those levels hitting their lowest in history. All eyes on Geneva, Switzerland, and tomorrow's one-on-one meeting between President Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin. We're getting some new insights into the Russian leader in that lengthy NBC News interview. In an excerpt released today, Vladimir Putin is suggesting that hundreds of people arrested for rioting at the U.S. Capitol are being subjected to what he called persecution for political opinions. The Russian president will be coming under some strong criticism from President Biden for moves against his own political opponents in Russia, particularly the imprisonment of opposition leader Alexei Navalny and the detention of thousands of Russian demonstrators who protested his arrest. Through a translator, more from that NBC News interview.
Can I ask you, just ask you a direct question? Did you order Alexei Navalny's assassination? Of course not. We don't have this kind of habit of assassinating anybody. That's one. Number two is, I want to ask you, did you order the assassination of the woman who walked into the Congress and who was shot and killed by a policeman? Do you know that 450 individuals were arrested after entering the Congress, and they didn't go there to steal a laptop? They came with political demands.
That was Russian President Vladimir Putin through a translator. The full interview is available on the NBC News website. And joining us from Qatar is Anatol Levin. He is a senior research fellow on Russia and Europe at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Tomorrow, the summit in Geneva between President Biden and Vladimir Putin. What, if anything, will come out of that meeting?
I think that, you know, there will be strong statements on both sides reaffirming basic principles. Both sides will make clear their red lines. I think that's important. Biden will tell Putin that, you know, any further Russian interference in the U.S. electoral process will, you know, have a very harsh response. He will, you know, warn Putin against any cyber sabotage of U.S. infrastructure. Putin will, you know, warn Biden that if Ukraine attacks Russian positions, you know, in the separatist area of eastern Ukraine, Russia will fight, will go to war, and that Russia will use any means necessary to prevent Belarus joining NATO. So they'll draw up their red lines. Then I hope that they will try to make some progress on areas where either Russia and the USA are basically, you know, on the same side and have the same interests, which is Afghanistan, for example, and other areas where progress is possible, you know, where there aren't or there don't need to be fundamental disagreements, and that is first and foremost nuclear arms reductions. And they might begin a conversation. I mean, it will only be the beginning of a conversation that could ultimately lead to a treaty on regulating cyberspace. I mean, that's a long way off, but, you know, if any progress is going to be made, then, you know, conversations have to begin now.
As you know, the White House has defended this meeting, saying that it's important for the U.S. to have an open dialogue with Russia. But some critics have said that we are rewarding Vladimir Putin by putting him on the international stage at this meeting, although we should point out there will not be a joint news conference following the summit tomorrow in Geneva, Switzerland. But how do you respond to that criticism that some have lodged towards the administration?
Look, I mean, by those standards, no U.S. president would ever meet you know, another leader with whom America had serious disagreements. You know, I mean, this is diplomacy, right? During the Cold War, when the Soviet Union was a far greater ideological adversary of America than Russia is today and challenged America, you know, in far more areas, U.S. presidents met with their Soviet counterparts in, you know, in order to reduce tensions, and of course, above all, to reduce the possibility of nuclear war and nuclear accidents. You know, it really isn't necessary in international affairs to like people, but you do have to talk to them. And I have to say, I mean, this notion that simply by talking to people, the United States is making some vast concession. This reminds me of Imperial China, you know, where the emperor wouldn't receive Western ambassadors because he couldn't accept that, you know, any other country could possibly be any kind of equal of China. You know, that's not the way the world works. I mean, the other point being, of course, that it reflects the American mood of the 1990s, when America was indeed the only superpower. Well, it isn't the only superpower today. There is also China, and, you know, China is a Russian option.
We're talking with Anatol Levin, who's also formerly a professor at Georgetown University in Qatar, which is where he is joining us today. And I want to go back briefly to China, because Russia is drawing closer to China, really as a counterbalance to the U.S., NATO, and other European Union members. So what's going on there?
It's just absolute. I mean, you know, this is geopolitics 101. Russia, I mean, not just Putin, Russia, the Russian establishment, feels under enormous pressure from the West in areas that it regards as its vital interests. It is not. I mean, it's receiving some concessions from parts of the West. I mean, above all, of course, Nord Stream to Germany. But certainly, you know, from Russia's point of view, America is paying, you know, no attention to what Russia regards as its vital interests. Inevitably, Russia is going to, you know, seek a different partner, as you say, to counterbalance America and the West. But that doesn't mean that Russia is moving into an alliance with China. You know, Russia will not fight alongside China for Taiwan any more than China will fight alongside Russia for eastern Ukraine.
Anatol Levin, who is with the Quincy Institute. He's joining us from Qatar, where it is evening. We thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.
Here in Washington, House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy calling on Speaker Nancy Pelosi to remove Representative Ilhan Omar from the House Foreign Affairs Committee after a controversial tweet that critics say compared Hamas and the Taliban to the U.S. and Israel. In the tweet, the Minnesota Democrat wrote the following, quote, "We must have the same level of accountability and justice for all victims of crimes against humanity. We have seen unthinkable atrocities committed by the U.S., Hamas, Israel, Afghanistan, and the Taliban," end of quote. Today, Leader McCarthy had this response during an interview on Fox News.
I think Nancy Pelosi should remove Omar from the Foreign Affairs Committee. This is an individual that has not once, but on numerous occasions, been anti-Semitic. Her own entire Congress had to rebuke her in the last one. But she's just not anti-Semitic. She's anti-American now. She's equating America to Taliban, to Hamas. She's discrediting our greatest ally in the Middle East, Israel, the only democracy. But the Democratic Party and the leader of that party, the Speaker, said on her Sunday show that she did not rebuke her. She thanked her. So the Democrats believe this message?
Right.
That is what's in doubt for me. I will promise you this. If we are fortunate enough to have the majority, Omar would not be serving on foreign affairs or anybody that has an anti-Semitic, anti-American view. That is not productive and that is not right.
That from Congressman Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, the House GOP leader. Now, in a statement issued last Friday, Congresswoman Omar wrote the following. To be clear, the conversation was about accountability for specific incidents regarding those international criminal court cases, not a moral comparison between Hamas and the Taliban and the U.S. and Israel. She went on to say, I was in no way equating terrorist organizations with democratic countries with well-established judicial systems. Well, Speaker Pelosi on Friday said that no further action would be taken against Representative Omar for her tweet, since she issued a follow-up statement to clarify her position. A group of House Republicans who have opposed those mask mandates and shutdowns during the coronavirus pandemic now calling for the removal of Dr. Anthony Fauci, accusing him of advocating unnecessary measures to stop the spread of coronavirus. We should point out Dr. Fauci has been the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases for nearly 40 years. His profile, of course, rising significantly last year. He essentially became one of the faces of the coronavirus pandemic response, leading the call for his removal, Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene.
The Fire Fauci Act will bring Dr. Fauci's salary down to zero and also will require the Senate to confirm someone to fill his position. You see, Dr. Fauci was not elected by the American people. He was not chosen to guide our economy. He was not chosen to rule over parents and their children's education. But yet, Dr. Fauci very much controlled our lives for the past year. Dr. Fauci, there is a lot of information that needs to come out on him. And as you all have seen with the emails that came out, that he owes the American people a lot of answers, but he also owes the world a lot of answers. These are emails that are very important that you all need to make sure that you're sharing with the public, because the public has suffered greatly. Businesses have closed. Small businesses have suffered. People have truly been depressed. Health consequences. People have died alone in hospitals and nursing homes. Children's education has been delayed by a year. And then we even witness suicide numbers going up, not in just adults, but young people, people in college, children in high school, children in middle school, and even younger. This isn't how our country was set up, and this is not how people should be governed. But yet it's Dr. Fauci, and through his advice that constantly changed, that is how things happened.
From today's Capitol Hill news conference with Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, in this question to the Georgia Republican, she was joined by Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks.
You know, you call it the China virus. You suggest that it's a bioweapon. There's no evidence of any of that. And we're also in the middle of a spate of attacks against Asian Americans. Aren't you just feeding that pretty irresponsibly?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And you're not going to turn this into something else. This is a virus that killed all kinds of people. It had nothing, has nothing to do with anyone's race or ethnicity. It has nothing to do with any of that. So, no, not at all. Yes.
Let me follow up on this.
Let's be real clear about something. I'm very disturbed that you would even ask that kind of question. Chinese Americans are not necessarily members of the Chinese Communist Party. Understand that the Communist Chinese Party rejects virtually every provision in what is known as our Bill of Rights. Recognize that the Chinese Communist Party does not believe in the kind of republic that we believe in. And for you to associate the Communist Chinese Party with Chinese Americans, as you have done, I would submit is egregious and wrong. But with respect to bioweapons, Marjorie Taylor Greene asked a really good question. Now, I serve on the House Armed Services Committee and on the Science, Space, and Technology Committee. Ask yourself, America, this question. When we talk about gain of function, let's be a little bit more specific about what we're talking about here. We're talking about a dangerous virus being changed so that it is much more communicable, meaning people are much more likely to get it, and or it becomes much more deadly. Now, why would any country do that with a virus to make it more contagious and make it more deadly, if not for militarization purposes? And if you look at the Communist Chinese Party's background and its relationship with the military, it leads you but to one logical conclusion.
That from Congressman Mo Brooks, joined by Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. One other note, the Houston Chronicle is reporting that Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz joining those House Republicans and calling for the ouster of Dr. Anthony Fauci. The White House says it stands by the work of Dr. Fauci. Also today, Southwest Airlines saying it has resumed normal operations and investigating the cause of technical issues that paused departing flights earlier today. Now, the outage was the second issue in less than 24 hours. The airline in a statement saying, quote, it is in the process of investigating the root cause of each event to determine the reason behind the technology issue. The airline was forced to cancel an estimated 500 flights because of the issue today. Now, data from the aviation tracking website FlightAware reporting 966 delays and show the cancellations and delays together affecting about 42% of Southwest Airlines' schedule this afternoon. In addition, for a while, the FAA issuing a temporary nationwide ground stop at the request of Southwest while the company resolved a reservation computer issue. We should point out just last night, the airline's third-party weather data provider experienced intermittent performance, issuing grounding planes and delaying travel across the U.S. last night on those Southwest flights. The Wall Street Journal has this headline: people are returning to restaurants, stores, and hotels, but not yet the office. And that means office towers and businesses around them are hurting. Peter Grant covers the commercial real estate beat for the Wall Street Journal. I asked him what surprised him the most in researching this story. He joined us on the phone from Brooklyn.
What's surprising is the slow rate at which employers are beginning to return their workforce back to the office space that they used to inhabit before the pandemic hit. We see restaurants reopening, bars reopening, people going back on planes. It seems like we're increasingly getting COVID in the rearview mirror in the U.S. The worst definitely seems to be over. But when you walk into a downtown area these days, it still seems like there aren't that many people walking around, and you begin to wonder, well, where is everybody?
So what we're seeing here in Washington, D.C., is you're reporting, you're seeing in other major cities, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco. My question, the economic impact it's having on the businesses that rely on those workers in the office space.
Well, the economic impact is huge. The stores and restaurants that are located near major business districts rely heavily on the workers that commute in and out every day, and they just haven't been there. So these small businesses have been clinging on to life for more than a year, and they've been expecting to see the workers returning, but they haven't. It hasn't happened yet, and they've been existing on government programs. They've been existing on deals they've been able to cut with their landlords, but there are big questions about how much longer they can keep doing that.
So with fewer than 3 out of 10 white-collar employees back in the office, you write that the return has been mostly piecemeal. What does the summer and early fall look like?
It looks like after Labor Day, we're going to see a big bump. If we keep seeing the current declines in infection rate and the increase in vaccinations, a lot of people are holding off until the fall because of school. That's always been a major factor in keeping people working from home. Also, I think employers have been very slow to react because employees don't want to go back, and employers don't want to have a heavy hand in this. They recognize that the whole country has been through a lot of trauma. The workers are tentative, and they don't want to be the first ones to say to the workforce, you have to get back here.
But why is that? Because as your headline indicates, people are going back to restaurants. Travel has picked up. Hotels are seeing a higher occupancy rate. We're going to shopping malls again. So why not the office?
There really are a mix of factors. First of all, if you just look at the health issue, when people walk into a restaurant or bar, they're choosing to do so. When you go to your office, that's part of your job. You have to be there. So once you're required to go there, then the whole issue of whether or not you want to put yourself at any kind of a health risk comes up. And the other issue that comes up is whether or not people have been vaccinated, whether employers can require people to let them know whether or not they've been vaccinated. There's a whole legal, ethical, human resources, political, financial can of worms here. It's not quite as simple as, well, I feel like I can go back to a restaurant and the governor says it's okay. And wow, look at that special they're advertising. Looks great.
We're talking with Peter Grant. He covers the commercial real estate industry for the Wall Street Journal. For many people, going back to the office may not mean 5 days a week. So what impact does that have on the economic ripple effect?
Well, that's going to have a big impact on the restaurants and bars and stores that count on these workers. It's also going to have a big impact on the value of these office buildings if the tenants wind up saying, I don't need quite as much space. Office buildings are major taxpayers in downtowns, and if their values go down, their tax rate is probably going to go down, and that's going to make it even harder for cities to rebound.
The story in The Wall Street Journal, available online at WSJ.com. Peter Grant, joining us from Brooklyn. We thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow lost 94 points, the Nasdaq dropping 101, the S&P was off by 8. Meanwhile, rents are going up. CNBC is reporting that single-family homes saw the largest gain in nearly 15 years, up by more than 5% in the last 12 months. And if you're renting, you're seeing an increase of between 2.5% to 4%. Finally, Mackenzie Scott, the billionaire philanthropist and the ex-wife of Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, announcing today she has given away more than $2.7 billion to hundreds of groups this year. In a blog post, Mackenzie Scott saying that she's donated to a total of 286 high-impact organizations focused on a variety of causes ranging from the arts and racial justice to higher education and combating domestic violence. The announcement marking her first donation since she remarried to Dan Jewett, who was a Seattle science teacher. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to listen and follow wherever you get your favorite podcast. And follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully in Washington, hoping you enjoy the rest of your Tuesday evening.